Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So yesterday we discussed a little bit of how Mayavad does not really make very good sense. It's not really very logical in different ways. In different ways, we discussed in 37 how if the upadis are actually real, these deluding impositions, conditioning limitations on Brahman, the one Brahman, if they are actually real, then doesn't really matter, because Brahman cannot be affected by anything, so they couldn't really limit Brahman, actually. And Brahman then, in 37, he goes on to say that more or less Brahman is something like the sky. At least if you think, if you try to find some material thing which could possibly in some way sort of represent Brahman or have some similarities to Brahman, perhaps the sky is the thing which is most similar, although it's not entirely similar, but at least some similarities are there. That the sky, you cannot hold a mirror up to it and then see. You cannot reflect it like that, because there's nothing, it is not reflectable. So Brahman is also not reflectable. And you cannot divide Brahman. So in different ways there in 37, he said that even if the upadis are real, they could not really have any bearing on Brahman. They could not affect Brahman. And of course, there is the point, although it's not mentioned here specifically, but if the upadis are real, that means that you have Brahman plus the upadis, and now it is not all one. Now there is two, or it depends how many upadis there are. However many upadis there are plus Brahman, that would be how many things you would have. You might end up with a lot of things. But at least you would have Brahman plus upadis, so there are two categories. So that contradicts the whole Mayavad idea, like fundamental idea, that it's all meant to be one. Then in 38, he makes the point again, if the upadis are real again, and if we are really caught by the upadis and deeply affected by them for a long time, we've been struggling under the upadis, then it's not just a matter of saying that I'm not affected, it's okay, they can't affect me. Yeah, I saw one time a cartoon. There's one Australian cartoonist who does cartoons of like topical subjects. So he did some cartoons on atomic war. And one cartoon was that the people had just dropped the bomb and the whole city was flat now, devastated. And the enemy plane which had dropped the bomb was flying overhead checking it out, and one man crawled out from the rubble and he shook his fist at the plane and said, "We will fight to the end." It was already the end. So you cannot just get up and say it's okay if you are actually under it like that. You know, it's a big job. If you're really caught like that, then it's a big job to get out of that situation. You cannot just say that, oh yes, now I will not be affected. It's not so easy. And then in 38, he said that if then the upadis are real, so you have a real problem in terms of getting free from them. But then, if you say that Brahman intervenes and helps you, and in that way you may get out of the problems, become free from the upadis, free from the conditioning, free from the limitations, by the mercy of Brahman, then effectively you are agreeing with the Vaishnav point of view. Yes, that by the mercy of Krishna, even though we are deeply entangled and it's very difficult, but Krishna can help us if we sincerely try. He'll carry to us what we lack and preserve what we have. He says that. He's kind to his devotees. It means just like if you mark a boundary. Yeah. It's like the boundary of a country. That is a delimiting factor. So then, 39, he examines what would be the situation if the upadis are not real and our entanglement is not existing at all. Then he says the whole thing makes no sense then. If there is nothing to be entangled in, that means you're not entangled. So, if the upadis are only apparently real, if they're not real, and then your so-called knowledge is, which delivers you, is also part of the unreality, which doesn't exist, then, anyway, the whole thing, if the upadis are unreal, if there are no upadis, no limitations, if there is no conditioning, then the whole thing becomes rather meaningless. Because then how come we are not realizing that we are all Brahman? And in 40, he kind of sums up, particularly right at the end of 40. Here we have avidya. Here we have ignorance. This is the fourth line from the bottom. Here we have ignorance within the pure spiritual being. Now that is not possible. Then you have the knowledge which will liberate within the upadi, that conditioned thing, that limited thing, that thing which is actually part of the whole illusory situation. But you have that knowledge which can liberate within the upadi called God or Ishvara, who has come into being simply because there is ignorance. That part of Brahman fell into ignorance and became the jiva. Then he needed to be supervised. So another part of Brahman became affected by this illusory situation, although not as much, and somehow or other has the capacity to liberate through being the source of knowledge. Anyway, so this Ishvara who has come about because of ignorance, actually, and, you know, which is an illusory status, illusory type of position, and that entity, Ishvara, who is an illusory type of entity, but still is the proprietor of that knowledge which can liberate. So then he says, we should carefully study how these and other similarly manufactured ideas are simply incoherent. It really doesn't make sense. No. Anyway, I'm not clear on that. On that translation, it doesn't sound so good to me. So I didn't get into that yesterday. It doesn't sound exactly correct. But the basic line of logic is summed up in the part that we just read. Avidya within Brahman, and then you get the jiva. So that is not possible. Then vidya, the knowledge which can liberate within the illusion called Ishwara, who has been concocted by that ignorance. So we should carefully study how these ideas, they really don't make sense. Then 41 said, pointed out how all these different ideas, and particularly the fundamental idea of oneness, does not comply with Vyasa's realization. It doesn't comply with that. He saw it. He saw the absolute. But, and the absolute with Maya, with the jiva, he saw all these things, but it didn't look like how the Mayavadis would expect it to look like. So that is also a serious problem. And also Shukadev's realization clashes with their idea. And he was one of them. Not a Mayavadi, he was a Brahmavadi, but he was definitely absorbed in the impersonal concept. But he went beyond it through genuine realization. Then 42, 43 was the idea of how to deal with scriptural statements which apparently suggest something contrary to what Vyas or Shukadev realized. So the point there is that you may have to interpret in terms of secondary meaning. What does that mean? It means that the author, ultimately the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and secondarily Vyas, who has edited all the Vedic literatures, that they had a special plan. Like, for example, just a good example is the Upanishads. The Upanishads are philosophically explaining all types of things to do with elevation. So, they're often saying that the Supreme is called Brahman. There is nothing beyond Brahman. Something like that. It's all one. Brahman is one. So, Vyas, of course, further on, has explained that there is Brahman, but then there are also other aspects, Brahmeti, but then Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti shabjite. So, sometimes, for example, with the Upanishads, he's dealing with a particular type of audience, so he is presenting things in terms of that audience. That is one strategy that he may use. There may be also other considerations why he may make some statement which appears to show some sort of impersonal idea or some idea of Brahman becoming divided or reflected or something like that. So there may be different reasons why. In a sense, it's just like with the Puranas, different demigods being promoted. So there are certain specific considerations there. So when you see that, if you happen to read some other Purana and you see that some demigod is being promoted, but then you can understand, like he said, I forget which verse it was, but it was one of the verses we read, I think last week probably, where if there's some statement that a certain demigod is the highest, but actually we know that this demigod is not because they're just a demigod, then you can take it that this is a relative statement, means relative to certain other demigods. gifts. So, you know, because there are different audiences, and because he may be trying to make different points in different cases, following certain streams of thought in other places. So, under certain circumstances, certain types of statements may be there. But understanding the realization of Vyas and Shukadev, then we should know that we have to apply the concepts which are implicit within their realizations, and then we can get a perspective. Then you can get a perspective on it. It's just like, to give you another example, very important example. In Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami goes to great lengths to establish that 1.3.28, that verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, Eti Chamsa Kala Pumsa, Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, that verse is the Paribhas Sutra of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he establishes it, and we accept it. So Paribhas Sutra, one part of the definition of what is a Paribhas Sutra, is that if you come across certain statements which are difficult to really understand, maybe difficult to understand, or they may even suggest some other idea, some different idea, but what you do is you apply the Paribhas Sutra. You apply the Paribhas Sutra to get a perspective on it. That if there's some verse which says that, yes, God is all... Because there are verses. They say God is all one, he's all pervading, he has no form. Then you know, this is Brahman. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti Shabjite. That Brahman is God. Because those three features, they're three features of one thing. In fact, we're going to be discussing that particular verse shortly. Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajgyanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabjate. That learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth, they call this non-dual advaya gyan, this non-dual absolute, Brahman Paramatma Bhagavan. So where there's some statement that God is all-pervading and so on, like we said, then going back to Vyasa's realization and our understanding, because that verse, in fact, he says, is like a secondary Paribhas Sutra. Eti Chamsa Kala Pumsa, that is the Paribhas Sutra. But then second is that verse. Eti Chamsa Kala Pumsa establishes that Krishna is the ultimate absolute. But then that verse establishes that Krishna has three features. Yeah. So when you come across this type of statement, pro-Brahman, pro-it's-all-one type of statement, then you can apply that verse, and then you know, yes, this is just that feature of Krishna. It is not that Vyas is now suggesting that Krishna is not a person ultimately. Okay, so that got us through 43, and now we're going to go on to the next subsection. Abhideya and Prayojana understood on the basis of Vyasa's realization. So all what we just read is actually from verse 29, I think. That was establishing the sambandha in terms of Vyasa's realization, and also taking into consideration Shukadev's realization, but mainly Vyasa's realization. So now Abhideya and Prayojana on the basis of the same realization. So And then that will complete this section. This section is what? We are defining the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. We decided up to verse 26 that our source of knowledge will be Srimad Bhagavatam. So now we are finding out what is the knowledge in Srimad Bhagavatam. What is the message? What is the absolute truth as it is being presented by Srimad Bhagavatam? So there are actually three stages to this. The first stage we're completing now. To be able to understand the absolute truth as described in Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of the realization of Vyasa and Shukadeva. Then, shortly, probably on Monday, I think, the next section, it's on page 67, is defining what is the message of Srimad Bhagavatam again. This time, in terms of understanding the jiva and the Supreme Brahman. So it's the same idea. We're defining the message. We're understanding what is the knowledge which Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting to us. And then, starting with verse 56, the last section of the whole book on page 76, understanding the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, defining the message of Srimad Bhagavatam by understanding how it presents the 10 topics that it has. It's a Mahapurana. Mahapuranas have 10 topics. So we will see how the Srimad Bhagavatam presents those 10 topics. Because that's what the Srimad Bhagavatam is about. It's about 10 things. Because it's a Mahapurana. So we'll see how it presents those 10 topics. And particularly the 10th, which is the ultimate topic. Anyway, that will be going into next week. For the time being, let us conclude then this section here, which is in which we're defining the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. What is the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of Vyasa's and Shukadeva's realizations? And this is a relatively simple section, subsection, you'll be happy to know. Text 44. Since the Supreme Lord and the Jiva thus have distinct identities, the Lord being the foundation of Maya, and the Jiva being deluded by her, that we've already established on the basis of Vyasa's realization. We can conclude, this is sort of an interesting deduction he makes, we can conclude, therefore, that devotional service to the Lord is the only recommended method for self-realization, the Abhideya. This conclusion follows logically from such scriptural statements as the following one in Bhagavad Gita 7.14, this divine energy of mind consisting of the three modes of material nature is difficult to overcome. Only those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Interestingly enough, that is not in the verse. I don't know how it got in there. But it's sort of part of the purport, really. Part of the commentary. The commentary is, well, in the verse he's making this statement. The Sanskrit is, bhajanas yaiva bideyatvam. That bhajan, devotional service, eva abhideya. Devotional service, eva, definitely. He's very emphatic about it. Devotional service is definitely the abhideya. So the logic behind that, well, of course, I mean, Srila Prabhupada would point out how the jivas, how the living entities in this world are always serving. We're serving our families, our nations, our dogs and cats, our senses. We're serving, serving, serving. So it is logical. It follows in that sense. And it also follows in the sense that there are many instructions in Shastra which say that. And this one which has appeared, has manifested here, although it's not actually in the verse, is a very appropriate verse. That seeing we are distinct from the Lord, and we are very small, and we are very weak, so it does make sense that we should surrender to the Lord and try to please Him and try and get His mercy and in that way get delivered. It is quite reasonable, actually. It's quite a reasonable idea. So he's saying that the Abhideya is being established like this. It's also a fact that the Abhideya is established in Vyasa's realization. Anyway, that's going to come in verse 46. 45. From the above discussion, we can see that the personality of Godhead is the most deserving recipient of perfect love. Because he's such a nice person. He instructs everyone about their ultimate welfare. Who else does that? No one does, unless they're his devotees and they're doing it on his behalf. But he is the original person who instructs people for their welfare, speaking Bhagavad Gita and so on. He removes all sorrows. Vyas has seen in 176 how the living entities were taking to devotional service, and they were the translation given by Prabhupada was that their miseries were becoming mitigated. Mitigated, of course, does not mean that they are being absolutely destroyed. Mitigated means they are being reduced considerably. So on the level, the idea is on the level of sadhana bhakti, it is not that the person becomes obviously perfect immediately, but there's definitely immediate effect that their miseries are mitigated considerably and their lives change quite quickly. Yeah. So in that way, the Lord removes all sorrow. He reciprocates with the people when they take up the process of devotional service, and he mitigates their miseries. And Vyas saw that. He is everyone's supreme self, like the sun in relation to its rays. Well, that example is self-evident, that we are like little small fragments of the energy of the Lord. So we are dependent upon Him. He is the original source. We are His energy. We are not some energy which exists independent. We are dependent. And in fact, this example of the sun and its rays is used in Shastra to depict the relationship. Yeah. So, in a certain sense, He is everyone's supreme self. He is like the self of the self. And in a sense, the proof of that is that we cannot become satisfied by trying to satisfy ourselves. We can only become satisfied when we try to satisfy Krishna. Then we become satisfied. So it is as if He is the self of the self, that inner self. In a certain sense, of course, this is not an impersonal idea, but in terms of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. And He is perfectly endowed with all wonderful qualities. He is such a nice fellow, Krishna. He is the nicest person you could ever meet. And Uddhava gives us a very clear example of that in the famous verse, Aho Bhakiyam Stanakala Kutam Jighamsaya Payad Apyasad V. Where will I find someone as merciful, as nice as Krishna, who will treat me like that? Where will I find such a person now that Krishna has gone? And he knows, I won't find such a person. There is no such person. So he's lamenting, losing the association of Krishna. No one is as nice as Krishna. Prabhupada, in the purport of that verse, it is 3:3-23. Prabhupada makes the point that a gentleman, one characteristic of a gentle person, cultured person like that, is that if there is some nonsense person that he has to deal with, he can overlook the nonsense. And if that nonsense person has just one little good quality, he'll take that. He'll not just get fried because the person is a nonsense and overlook the little good quality and say, well, the person is so much nonsense, I'm not interested. No. He can take that little good quality and magnify that. And that is a sign of a person who is very qualified and very cultured, very gentle and very advanced person. So that's Krishna. So, therefore, what 45 is saying is that because Krishna is so nice and so wonderful in these ways, then developing love for him must be the prayojana. Entering into a personal, eternal personal relationship with such a person, the ultimate person, it must be the prayojana. We're establishing Abhideya and prayojana on the basis of Vyasa's realization. So let's go on to 46. In trance, Srila Vyasadeva also perceived the process of self-realization. He has been explaining logically in 44 and 45 without directly referring to Vyasa's realization. Now he's just going to confirm these things through, again, bringing Vyasa's realization to our attention. In trance, Srila Vyasadeva also perceived the process of self-realization, Abhideya, as described above in text 44. Then, to propagate it, he composed for the saintly Vaishnavas this scripture called Srimad Bhagavatam. Sri Suta Goswami describes all this in the verse beginning, Anatha, Anatha Pashamam Sakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhoksajay. In this verse, the word Bhakti Yoga refers to sadhana bhakti, regulated devotional service, which is characterized by hearing, chanting, and so on, and not to prema bhakti, devotional service and pure love of God. This is the correct interpretation, because sadhana bhakti depends on instruction, while love of God depends only on the Lord's grace. Yeah. When you're on the level of prema, you don't need people to come along and tell you, you shouldn't do this, you should do that, watch out for this. You don't need it. You're running on the Lord's mercy. You're based, everything is based on the Lord's mercy. The Lord's mercy is just flowing all over you. Just to refer back to that verse, just so we know what we're talking about, 30.1 on page 49, it's the middle verse there, Anatho Pashamam Sakshad, Bhakti Yoga Madhoksajay, Lokasya Janato Vyasash, Chakre Satvata Samhitam. So he says that the material miseries of the living entity, which is superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service, but the mass of people do not know this. And therefore the learned Vyasadeva composed this Vedic scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. So there it's quite clear. Because the people are suffering and they need They need that mercy. They need that mitigating influence of devotional service. So therefore, Vyas composed this Vedic scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, to instruct them to take to it, and once they've taken to it, how to apply it, how to advance, and then gradually they can come to the perfect level. So 46.2. Even so, sadhana bhakti, being the means for gaining the Lord's grace, ultimately matures into love of Godhead. So in other words, there is nothing wrong with the idea that they should take up sadhana bhakti. It is good. It is very good, because it is going to lead to prema bhakti. Thus it is said that sadhana bhakti directly removes the jiva's miseries, anatho pasamam sakshad, without depending on anything else. Even on that level, sadhana bhakti, even on that level, bhakti is working independent of any other possible type of facility which arguably might be able to help you. You don't need it. You just need sadhana bhakti. As the Lord states in Srimad Bhagavatam 11, 20, 32, and 33, everything that can be achieved by fruitive activities, penance, knowledge, detachment, mystic yoga, charity, religious duties, and all other means of perfecting life is easily achieved by my devotee through loving service unto me. If somehow or other my devotee desires promotion to heaven, liberation, or residence in my abode, he easily achieves such benedictions just through devotional service. By contrast, such methods as cultivating knowledge, they depend on devotional service for success, as shown in such statements as the following. The following statement will show us that another process cannot actually give the result. So indirectly, it is saying that all other processes are dependent on devotional service. So this is Lord Brahma now, 10.14.4. My dear Lord, devotional service unto you is the best path for self-realization. If someone gives up that path and engages in the cultivation of speculative knowledge, he'll simply undergo a troublesome process and will not achieve his desired result. As a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization. His only gain is trouble. Which is another way of saying that independent of devotional service, no other process will really work. So that means that all the other processes are dependent on devotional service, if you turn it around a bit. Or else, the meaning of anatho pashamam sakshad is that sadhana bhakti, without relying on any intermediate process, directly counteracts the material miseries. Mitigates. Prabhupada used the word mitigate. So it counteracts them directly. But that only pure love of God, the mature fruit of sadhana bhakti, can counteract the two fundamental faults of bewilderment and misidentification. Thus the Abhideya is expressed here in that verse, Anatho Pashamam Sakshad 176, as we have seen in text 29, Shukadev's realization, and 31, 32, 30 also, Vyasa's realization. The idea being that sadhana bhakti mitigates, it reduces considerably all those illusions and fearful situations. But prema bhakti totally eliminates bewilderment. What was the Sanskrit from the previous verse for bewilderment? Yaya samohito jiva. And misidentification, manute. He considers himself to be the body. Yeah. So these two fundamental aspects of material consciousness are cut out or pulled out at the root, totally eliminated by prema bhakti. On the level of sadhana bhakti, they're considerably mitigated, considerably reduced, and that is good. That is very good. So there we have the Abhideya again. And now on to verse 47 for some more confirmation about Prayojana. Next, to clarify the final goal, Prayojana, as described above in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.7.4-6, and to affirm that the Purana Purusha mentioned in 1.7.4 is in fact Lord Krishna, then Suda Goswami speaks the next verse, 1.7.7. So let's just quickly look back there, page 49 again. Yasyam vai shruyamanayam krishne paramapuruṣe bhaktir utpadyate pumsa shoka moha bayapaha. Simply by giving one's oral reception to this Vedic scripture, the feeling for loving devotional service to Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, sprouts up at once to extinguish the fire of lamentation, illusion, and fearfulness. So, there you have it. Krishne Paramapuruṣe. Confirmation that the Prayojana, because this is expressing the Prayojana here, that loving devotional service comes, not just sadhana bhakti, but prema comes, and then all that bewilderment and illusion, whatever, is totally eliminated. So back then to 47.1, while describing the effect of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam in this verse, he reveals another of Srila Vyasadeva's realization. In this verse, the word bhakti refers to pure love of Godhead, because that is the goal achieved through executing the devotional practice of hearing. Yasyam vai shruyamanayam, through hearing about Krishna Paramapuruṣe, then that bhakti, that love comes. So, the word utpadyate is generated. Here means it becomes manifest. It doesn't mean it exactly is produced by it, but it is manifested through engaging in the process of hearing very nicely and advancing to that point through that practice. So that bhakti, that love, becomes manifest. And the manifestation of pure love of God is shoka moha baya paha. That is, it destroys all lamentation, illusion, and fear. The implication being that even their subtle remnants are destroyed. Not just mitigating, but on every level, even the most subtle, fine level of some trace, everything is completely destroyed. And then he says, this is confirmed by the words of Rishabhadev over the page. Rishabhadev says, therefore, until one has love for Lord Vasudev, till one comes to the level of loving Krishna, the Prayojana, who is none other than myself, he is certainly not delivered from having to accept a material body again and again. In other words, you have to come to the level of pure love of God. Otherwise, you may have to take birth again. Of course, if you're a devotee, then you can take birth as a devotee. But, you know, better to become perfect in this lifetime, because we see that many people who are born devotees in devotee families, we see it with our own eyes. So many cases, they may not do so well in the next life when they're born in a devotee family. They may not do so well. So better to just get completely out of material existence. Come to the level of love of God, then Rishabhadev says, then you definitely don't need to take material body again. Means everything, all that material contamination is totally removed. So then, 47.2, in this verse, 177, the word Paramapurusha for the Supreme Person refers to the same Purna Purusha mentioned earlier. And here he's going to give some confirmation. What is his form? To this, Sri Suda Goswami replies, Krishna. In other words, for those whose hearts are enriched with thousands of scriptural statements, such as Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. And for those who are attracted to his glories and fame by hearing through a bona fide disciplic succession, as soon as they hear his name, their minds are filled with his presence. And as soon as such persons chant the first syllable of his name while uttering his mantra, the Lord's attention is also drawn to the chanter. That is the form denoted by the word Krishna in this verse. And this is confirmed by the author of Nama Kaumudi. It's a dictionary. It's a very famous dictionary. The conventional meanings of the name Krishna are one who is black like a tamal tree, he who is breastfed by Sri Yashoda and the Supreme Brahman. That's just a few might think that when Vyas says Krishna Paramapurusha, he might be referring to someone else other than Krishna who appeared 5,000 years ago. So how are we doing? Is everyone okay? Are we with it? Are we all here? Okay, Hare Krishna, excuse me for that. Just trying to make sure our attention is there. Let's go on to text 48. I think that's all pretty self-evident there, 47.2. Now, this is important now. 48 and 49, they're very nice. They're very nice. These are the concluding verses now in this whole section which is dealing with Vyasa's realization and Shukadev's realization. Yeah. So these are important verses. 48. Srila Vyasadeva experienced that this final goal, the bliss of pure love of God, is superior to even Brahmananda, the happiness derived from realizing the impersonal aspect of the Supreme. This we know because Vyasadeva taught Shukadev Goswami Srimad Bhagavatam, so he could taste the special bliss derived from love of Godhead. Even though Shukadev was already absorbed in Brahmananda, he shared Shukadev's experience, so he knew, he realized through seeing what Shukadev went through. Suta Goswami states this in the verse beginning, Sa Samhitam. Well, back to page, what was it? 49. Whatever it is, 49, is it? Yeah. Last verse there. You see, we're painstakingly going through all these verses, because this is Vyasa's realization. Sasamitam bhagavatim kritvanukramya chatmajam shukam adya payama sa nivriti niratam munin. The great sage Vyasadeva, after composing the Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it, that is going to come up also, the two-step procedure, taught it to his son, Sri Shukadeva Goswami, who was absorbed in renunciation. Okay. So, in this verse, the phrase kritvanukramya, after compiling and revising, indicates that Vyasadeva first wrote Srimad Bhagavatam in an abbreviated form. And then later on, after being instructed by Sri Narada Muni, he expanded and rearranged it. Thus, two apparently contradictory statements are reconciled. One found here in the Bhagavatam saying that the Bhagavatam was composed after the Mahabharata. That is there. And the other found elsewhere in the Skanda Purana, Prabhaskanda, saying that the Mahabharata was compiled after the 18 Puranas. So there you go. The word Nivritti Nirata, attached to renunciation, implies that because of his absorption in the bliss of Brahman, Sri Shukadeva was living a life of complete renunciation from which he never deviated. Total renunciation. Absolute renunciation. He was really Brahman realized in the extreme. Clothes, people, food, social considerations were absolutely meaningless to him. Okay. And then verse 49 elaborates on this. In reply to a question posed by Sri Shonaka in 179. Now, this is referring, we've been looking at 30.1, right, on page 49. But then in 30.2, there were further verses from that sequence. Page 50. Here we have now this verse which is being referred to. Shonaka is asking Sutta that if Sukadev was already Brahman realized and fully satisfied in that, then why did he undergo the study of Srimad Bhagavatam? This is a big job. Big job. Learning and learning. He was already there in terms of Brahman realization. So why? And then Sutta speaks the Atmarama verse and the verse following it, which express the principle that all types of Atmaramas can be attracted to Krishna, and so Shukadeva was attracted. Because Krishna has qualities which are spiritual, but they are the highest manifestation of spirit. And therefore, even a person who is absorbed in spirit, Brahman level, lower level, if he's exposed to those qualities, those spiritual qualities, he can be attracted. Okay, so back to 49.1. In reply to a question posed by Sri Shonaka, Sutta Goswami speaks the verse beginning Atmaramas Cha. This is what we've just referred to. Further explaining what Srila Vyasadeva experienced in trance and showing logically how it is consistent with the experience of all sages who take pleasure in the self. In this verse, the word nirgrantha, free from bondage, means beyond the rules and regulations described in the scriptures, or free from the knot of false ego. Sort of the same thing, really. Because if you're free, if you're beyond the rules and regulations of Shastra, that means you've become free from false ego. And if you're free from false ego, means you've gone beyond the rules and regulations of the scriptures. The word ahaitu kim, causeless, means not desiring any results. And to put an end to all doubts, Sri Sutta says, indeed, the nature of Lord Hari is such that even Atmaramas feel attracted to him. Not just Shukadev, actually there are many cases. The four Kamas, there are also cases. And 49.2, this is now important in terms of the chronology, the history, what happened with Shukadev, what is the story. 49.2, in the next verse, beginning Harir Guna, Sutta reiterates this idea by relating Shukadev's experience. Let us just quickly go back to page 50. Hope you don't mind me jumping around like this, but just so we get it all clear. So the second statement there is, this is 1710, this is actually 1711. Srila Shukadeva Goswami, the son of Srila Vyasadeva, was not only transcendentally powerful, he was also very dear to the devotees of the Lord. Thus, his mind captivated by the enchanting qualities of Lord Hari, he underwent the study of this great narration, Srimad Bhagavatam. So, back to page 66, 49.2. In the next verse, that verse, Sutta reiterates this idea by relating Shukadeva Goswami's experience. First, so this is now the history. First, when Shukadeva Goswami heard Srila Vyasadeva recite a few selected Bhagavatam verses describing Lord Hari's attributes, Shukadev's attention was drawn away from the bliss of impersonal Brahman, and his heart was captivated. Later, Shukadev studied the complete Bhagavatam, despite its vast size. And thereafter, Lord Vishnu's devotees became very dear to him, his affection for them growing as he daily discussed the Lord's pastimes with them. Or else the word Vishnu Janapriya means that he became dear to them. Actually, it's both cases are true. The purport is as follows. The Brahma Vaivarta Purana relates how Sri Shukadev, even while in the womb of his mother, realized that Lord Sri Krishna could completely dispel Maya's influence by virtue of his independence. So he heard some verses. Then he got Krishna's association. This is just as he was coming out or just before he came out, right at that time. So Krishna consciousness was instilled within his heart at that point. Yeah. Although up to that point he is known only as being Brahman realized. But certain amount of Krishna consciousness was instilled at that point. Subsequently, on Shukadev's request, Vyasadev brought the Lord to his hermitage. And when Shukadev saw Lord Krishna before him, even as he lay within the womb, he became free from Maya's influence. Considering his life successful, Shukadev at once departed alone. This is described in the second chapter of the first canto. He just ran away. Vyas ran after him, calling out, but only the trees echoed in response. If you're familiar, I think it's 1:2:2, something like that. So, Shukadev at once departed alone. Thereafter, Srila Vyasadev, knowing that he could control Shukadev only with Srimad Bhagavatam, somehow made him hear some selected Bhagavatam verses describing Lord Krishna's super excellent characteristics. In this way, he captivated Shukadev's heart, and later he taught him the entire narrative. Thus is declared the supreme glory of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is all very important, isn't it? From the historical point of view, understanding how it is all happening. Shukadev was there within the womb, he was Brahman realized. He wouldn't come out. So the Lord got, Vyas got Lord Krishna to come. Krishna convinced him that you'll be all right. He accepted that. He developed some attachment to Krishna. He came out. He ran away. Then the story is, although Jiva Goswami says, somehow Vyas arranged to gain control of Shukadev by having him hear verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. So the story is, we mentioned, he sent some of his disciples and told them, you just keep reciting certain, he says, selected Bhagavatam verses. Now, actually, we don't know what those verses are. But some people say that the verse that I just mentioned, Aho Bhakiyam Stana Kala Kutam, 3:2:23, some people feel that is maybe one of those verses. Anyway, it was some special Bhagavatam verses. So those disciples were going around just reciting and reciting. Then they found this mad young teenager was following them, and they realized it's him. So then they brought him back. And when they brought him back, then Vyas sat him down and instructed him in Srimad Bhagavatam. And Vyas at that point, anyway, he had finished his work of revising, recompiling or whatever, Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so finally 49.3, and that will be the end for today. This is the very end of this section to do with Vyasa's and Shukadev's realizations. From the above, we can see that the speaker, Shukadev Goswami, and Srila Vyasadev had the same realizations. And therefore, we should always study the message of Srimad Bhagavatam in the light of Shukadev's realizations, or Vyasa's actually, but particularly Shukadev's, because they're considered to be extra special, not otherwise. By implication, we should consider any other interpretation merely speculative and thus deviant from the correct understanding. The verse under discussion, 1711, was spoken by Sri Suta Goswami. Yeah, so there you have it. Vyasa's realization was that he was frustrated. He thought he had completed everything. But then Narada came and said, no, you need to glorify Krishna more. So he told him, you go into trance and you realize Krishna more. So he did that. And he had his realization, as was expressed there in text 30. All those verses, that series of verses from the seventh chapter of the first canto. And as a result, well, he had come to the level of Krishna Prema. He became attached to Krishna. He developed love for Krishna. He saw Krishna. He realized God face to face. So then Shukadev Goswami, what was his realization? His realization was, it begins with hearing some verses. Then Krishna comes and instructs him that it's okay, you can come out. So he's now getting attached to Krishna. Then those devotees come, they're chanting all those verses about Krishna. He becomes so attracted, he comes back, and he becomes absorbed in studying Srimad Bhagavatam. Then he goes and he speaks Srimad Bhagavatam when Maharaj Parikshit asks him, what is the goal of life? What is the highest, topmost thing? So Shukadev said, Krishna. Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. That was his realization. So therefore in this verse, this part of 49.3, Jiva Goswami says that therefore we can understand that Shukadev and Vyas had the same realizations. You know, it all came about in different ways, but they had the same realizations. And they are the authorities. They are the authorities on Srimad Bhagavatam. And Vyas is the authority on all the Vedas. So here, of course, Jiva Goswami is saying that if we want to understand any statements, the message or any statements within Srimad Bhagavatam, then if we want to understand these things clearly, that has to be in conformity with the realizations of Shukadev, well, particularly Shukadev, because he's like the supreme authority on Srimad Bhagavatam, and Vyasadev also, because he's the supreme authority on the Vedas and all of the other Vedic literatures, including Vedanta Sutra. So therefore, you could extend the statement here and say that, therefore, we should always study the message of the Vedas in the light of Vyasa's realization and Shukadev's realization, and not otherwise. And any other apparent idea which may be seemingly put forward, which contradicts their realizations, even anywhere in the Vedic literatures. But we should understand that this is deviant. This is not correct. And then we should do whatever is necessary to line it up. Line it up with Shukadev. Line it up with Vyas in terms of their realization. Is that okay? Okay. So on Monday we'll move forward with the next section 6. You can please read this over the weekend. It's not so long, just a few pages. It's pretty philosophical, but just read it and we'll discuss it on Monday. Any comments or questions, Mataji? That's a very interesting point. Mataji is making a social comment about all of us. It's true. You know, we struggle sometimes to appreciate Krishna. Sometimes some devotees, they leave Krishna. They think, let me just go away from Krishna consciousness. So that, you know, that's such an expression of lack of appreciation. But even Krishna is an ocean of good qualities, an unlimited ocean of good qualities. He only has good qualities. He does not have any bad qualities. But still, here we are thinking, well, should I surrender to him or not? Or how much should I? Or, you know, something like that. We have not, to date, totally surrendered and totally, you know, the actual realization of who is Krishna and what is our opportunity here. That hasn't really dawned on us. Anyway, you know, that's because the upadis are real. The upadis are real. And we are really in Maya. It is true. We are really in Maya. So, you know, the process of sadhana bhakti as vyas saw it means that process of gradually moving forward and gradually we appreciate Krishna more. So then it starts accelerating, you see. As you appreciate some good qualities more, then it'll start accelerating because more and then more and then more until through, in terms of realization, it becomes overwhelming. So the impetus increases, yeah, as one advances. Aparad. Yeah. So through sadhana bhakti, we have to remove our aparads, and then all these things, everything will become clearer and nicer. Envious. Question is, what do you call a person if they can't appreciate another person, even if that person has so many good qualities? Baladev Vijayabhushan, it's one thing that really struck me. In his commentary, I think it's on Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, verse 1, where Krishna says that, Arjuna, I'm going to give you the most confidential knowledge now because you're not envious of me. So Baladev Vijayabhushan says there, or somewhere around there, that envy means, if you really want to know what is envy, that you search to find fault, even in the midst of many good qualities. But no, you don't see the good qualities. You search, where's the fault? Ah, there's a fault. Now I've got it. Now I understand this person. You know, one devotee once said to Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, there had been some program and some people had got up in the middle of the program and criticized Prabhupada. There were a few programs like that here and there. So after such a program, one devotee said, Srila Prabhupada, I can't understand it. This rascal got up and he said these things, criticizing you. How can he do that? How could he do it? You're such a wonderful person. Prabhupada said, what? That's nothing. Even when Krishna was here, people were criticizing him and finding fault with him. So someone who is envious will be able to find fault even where it doesn't exist. The example is Ramachandra Puri, who was trying to find fault with Lord Chaitanya. He just couldn't. But one day he saw some ants crawling along. And then he thought, got it. There's the fault. There was a deduction, a process of deduction. Ants come where there are sweets. Of course, ants, in the next verse, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that ants go everywhere, actually. They go all over the place. But his deduction was that ants go where there are sweets. So this Chaitanya has been eating sweets, and he's meant to be a sannyasi. Shame. Just see what a unfortunate situation. Yeah. So it's something like that. Hare Krishna. Okay, so we'll see you all on Monday. Please read through section 6 from verse 50 to verse 55.